There had been a terrible drought. My garden was empty of flowers, so there were no bees, no cicadas. I resented the wallabies that stole into our orchard and ate every green tip off the fruit trees.
After the fire, there was such a silence and a deficit of bird life. It was eerie.
This episode contains stories of animals in distress. This is From the Embers, a series centred on the experiences of 9 Australian communities affected by the 2019-2020 bushfires. I'm Sarah Mashman. As fires raged across Australia and houses were threatened and lost, people evacuated from their homes. Alice and Sarah, our New South Wales reporter, was one of those people.
Sure, I was worried about my house. I mean, I evacuated it 3 times over 6 weeks with 2 small children. I'd just gotten back from our second evacuation and I was so happy to be home. I missed our beds, our community. And then I checked my phone. I had a missed call from my friend Robin, an RFS firefighter.
Alice, this is Robin. You should evacuate from Maruya now. You've got, you can come up and stay at our place. It's unlocked. We're just heading down to Maruya to fight this fire. You need to evacuate now, all right? Come and stay at our place, all right?
Maruya, where Alice had literally just unpacked her evacuation bags.
I just grabbed my mask, the kids. My baby was napping, so I snatched her from the cot as we ran out the door and into the car. It was a totally unexpected fire, and it was a big one. The fire front went over my house, but the RFS saved it. Some of my friends weren't so lucky.
I lived up until New Year's Eve in Ridge Avenue on the south coast of New South Wales.
Nick Hopkins lived on a small bush block on the side of a ridge.
So we're just passing now 2 houses that were completely destroyed as the fire moved very, very quickly through here on the morning of New Year's Eve. Just turn left in here. We can just park here. What we're looking at now is a whole series of brick piers on which our house was constructed. Honestly, if you were to drop a 1 megaton bomb on this house site, it wouldn't have done a better job than what this fire has done. The debris is probably about a metre thick in some places. And I can recognise various bits and pieces of my previous life. Over there we've got the range hood from the stove, we've got the washing machine just lying here. Every single tile that was on the roof has come down and smashed on the ground here.
Into hundreds of thousands of pieces.
This is a broken tile. Would you like to come into my workshop? It's a mass of twisted metal, the roof's half caved in. I can only ever be in here for about a minute or two at a time. The fact that it now looks like this is such a kick in the guts, it's quite hard to describe. To stay here is to begin to drown in those feelings. So I think we should probably leave the workshop now and go out into the open air. I can breathe a bit more easily. I'm looking at the regenerating limbs of the trees on our land, and that fills me with hope that the bush has quite a degree of resilience that we don't credit it with.
We sat in the car looking down at the pile of rubble that had been Nick's house.
We knew that it was indefensible and that we should just get out. And by 8 o'clock that morning, we'd evacuated down to the beach at Malua Bay. And we watched the smoke get thicker and thicker and there was a sickening feeling that some of that smoke would have been coming from our house. And we came back, we saw, oh, that house survived, or that one didn't. And as we came in our driveway, we could see the flames still burning on our house, and we knew that ours was one of the unlucky ones. I was aware that it wasn't just my home and my neighbours' homes that were potentially going up in smoke. It was the habitats of all these critters.
Scientists say the figure of a billion animals dying during these fires is conservative. If we count invertebrates like spiders and bees, it's more likely 240 billion.
I can't believe it's just too big for the human brain to comprehend that kind of figure and the amount of suffering that that equates to. What about all the native animals that are caught up in a major wildfire, like if they're macropods and they're hopping to get away and they're hopping the wrong direction? What if it's travelling so fast that you can only get away by flying? So you've got wings and you can fly away. Well, good luck, because you've got to choose the right direction to fly in for a start. But wherever you land is going to be already colonised by other members of your species. So it definitely was front and centre of my mind at the time, which made it so much more distressing.
The animals that survive the fires can't just move into the nearest tree or make their home in a pre-existing burrow, and they can't go back to their patch until the scorched earth regenerates.
They live in sacks that I hang up, suspend across a rope. Different joeys like different teats. One of mine sucks much faster than the other. I'm just going to go back to the microwave and see how this bottle is defrosting. So this one here holds with both hands, holds the bottle with hands, and this one always holds with one hand.
Julie Taylor Mills bottle feeds joeys around the clock.
Of all the animals that I've cared for, the kangaroos are the ones, even more so than wallabies. You have them for longer, you get to know them better, so you actually get quite attached to them, in a sense of getting to know their personalities.
She's a volunteer with the New South Wales Wildlife Information Rescue and Education Service. You might know them as WIRES.
I had 11 animals in care, 3 ringtails, 1 brush tail, 2 swamp wallabies, 2 redneck wallabies and 3 little eastern grey joeys. And then I've got this bushfire crisis. When on ABC radio it went to a message saying, if you live between Maruya and Churros Heads, take cover as the fire front goes over, it's too late to leave, then I just went cold.
Julie released the wallabies out the gate. She strung a rope for the brush tail possum. And then she loaded up her 5-door sedan to drive to the nearby headland.
With 3 joey bags, and I had a box full of the ringtail possums, and I shrouded it in a rug and put that in the back of the car. So the joey sacks hang over the headrests into the back. I put the car down on the point with the joeys and the possums in it, and my next door neighbour didn't turn up, so I got on the bicycle and went down, and his son-in-law appeared. We spent the next 6 hours fighting the fires there because the wind kept fluking, then it'd go another way, and actually it was a really empowering experience. I didn't think I'd ever end up fighting a fire, and then I went back and fed the joeys. They were all just hanging out in the car, just sitting there. I'd left the windows open, don't worry, and I'd left the vent over the top open.
Julie has specifically designed enclosures for the wildlife that come into her care. As for how they get there, it usually starts with a phone call.
Before the bushfires, we'd have 3 or 4 calls a day for our region, and maybe one of them might be a kangaroo. If it's a kangaroo, it's usually early in the morning, someone's hit it, and that's when they come in, the kangaroo calls. Then birds during the day, maybe a turtle or a ringtail or a goanna. In the height of the bushfires, we were getting 15 to 20 calls a day, almost exclusively macropods. That's kangaroos and wallabies. They're wild animals and they've got burns. Those burns need to be bandaged, And you have to sedate the animal in order to bandage them because they're big, solid animals that are quite strong. What disturbs me more than dealing with the macropods is the fact that that's all we were getting. All the other animals, we weren't getting them in. And yet they can't fly to escape. They can't run like kangaroos. So where were they? They're just gone. So all the possums, the gliders, the who knows what happens to the wombats, echidnas, lizards, snakes. And we eventually accepted that in the few weeks after the fires, there were animals that we could maybe help. Then the animals after that would have infections if they had burns. They'd come back to where they foraged and they'd come in contact with charcoal and burning pieces, and then that infection had set in. There was no hope for them after that.
There's a vitally important role carried out by a small number of WISE volunteers, shooters. They're called in to euthanise animals that cannot recover. And during the bushfires,
they were finding it really, really hard. They didn't join WISE to shoot animals, but that's what they were finding that they had to do.
WISE and fires is what I want to do now. But I knew that one day the two would converge, and that was January and February.
Rachel McInnes is an RFS senior deputy captain, and for many years she's done in-house care for injured birds and rescues animals like lizards, snakes and joeys.
I started with WISE because I was seeing a lot of kangaroos that had been hit on the side of the road. At Potato Point, we're only one road in and out from the highway, and it's 9 kilometres of bush. One day I saw one that was still alive, and then I realised I need to be able to do something to help. And I've always loved animals anyway. I'd always just been a little bit worried about, well, what could I do? Could I do something? Through WISE, you learn how to do first aid. After I joined, one of the first things I did come across was a kangaroo that had been hit by a vehicle and it had a joey. And I thought, aha, I know what to do now. So after doing the WISE course, I learned how to extract a joey, and I was able to take that joey and straight down to a carer and to get it looked at.
She's also a shooter.
I knew straight after the fires there would be that time when we were starting to get calls in to euthanise the animals here and rescue, but mostly euthanising after a fire.
Before becoming a WISE shooter, Rachel had never shot a living creature. She'd only fired at targets on a rifle range.
In the 80s, I was in Alice Springs working for some lovely employers, and they said, well, this is what we do on the weekends. We go out to a shooting range and we just shoot targets. And so for 2 years, that's what I did, knowing that I never wanted to shoot an animal that was just about target shooting, and I was actually not too bad at it. So fast forward, I thought, okay, I can draw on that experience and I can put that skill to use. So I had to go through a lot of training. WISE don't take this lightly, and I certainly do not take it lightly. I started doing it because I saw the need. As I'm approaching, I always talk to them. I always apologise for what I'm going to do. It's a headshot. I do it as quickly as I can and as accurately as I can. I stay with them until I know that they're dead. Then I go through the process of checking whether it's male or female. If she's got a joey, I'll extract the joey and get it into a little pouch, keep it warm, and get it to a carer as soon as possible.
Rachel remembers her worst day during the recent fires. An inferno had gone through a week before.
The calls started coming. The first day was just awful. So as I was walking through to euthanise the kangaroos with burnt feet, there was nothing on the ground. There was no green whatsoever. The kangaroos, they would be trying to stay ahead of the fire, but if they're disoriented, they're going to go bounding back through burnt ground. And the thing about the burnt ground is you can't see that it's burnt. It looks all right, but it's hot to the touch, and they might not realise that until they've already started bounding through. It doesn't take much for their feet to burn, and it doesn't just stop burning. They can't move. They certainly can't find any food. They're quite often on their own because they can't keep up with the mob. I did 12 in one day, and the very last one I went to was a big female. She was really struggling, and I saw her stand up and I thought, oh my goodness, she's got a joey. Before I euthanized her, I promised that I would take her joey and I would find a carer. So that's what I did. I called one of our joey carers and I delivered this beautiful little bundle named Strawberry. She's going to grow up to be a big girl.
There were only three shooters working across 150 kilometres of the far south coast.
It was just very, very difficult. I asked for help. I had enough of crying. It was just starting to really, really get to me.
Rachel knew that it had to be done. It just couldn't be done quick enough.
At the height of the bushfires, we had a team that came down from Wires in Sydney, and they were there to help us because our rescuers, who were licensed shooters, just couldn't cope.
And for some wildlife volunteers, only someone who has been there can understand.
Because I've been a rescuer, I've been a carer. I know how heartbreaking it is when animals die.
Frances Carlton was in the middle of setting up a new pro bono counselling service, Wild Talk, specifically for wildlife carers. When the fires hit in southern New South Wales, she'd turned her phone off for a brief holiday.
I was planning on finishing a quilt in that time.
But on Boxing Day, when she turned her phone back on,
I had 6 calls. I woke up the next morning and I had another 5 calls, and then I had another 7 calls, and then I had another 4 calls. And by the time I got to sort of a couple of days before New Year's, I went, I'm going to have to launch Wild Talk early. But basically I just went, fuck, this is bad. It was literally people howling down the phone at me and expressing complete hopelessness. And they were describing some of the most horrific scenes you could possibly imagine. I had people describe doing black walk. Black walk is when they go in to a burnt out area. They're looking for animals and they're finding hundreds of dead animals, but they're also finding lots of animals that are so far gone they need to be euthanized, and they have to do it as quickly and painlessly as possible, and they can't always do it themselves. And then of course there's also the fact that a lot of them had to wait days, if not weeks, before they were allowed into the areas to search for animals
because of other dangers.
Yeah, other dangers. You know, the fact that the grounds were so hot still that they, you know, could spontaneously ignite again. I mean, people are hearing noises from animals that they don't normally hear, which is only created by extreme pain. It's koalas, it's kangaroos, it's lizards, it's everything has been making noises that people don't normally hear. Suddenly these animals are really sort of earning that sentient label, because so many people have suddenly been going, oh my God, what about the wildlife?
And so many people, including me, wanted to be a part, to help in some way.
A couple of very high profile people like Ellen DeGeneres and Obama saw the WISE website and they started tweeting that this is the organisation to help assist Australia's wildlife.
I love Australia, and right now Australia needs our help. Wildfires have been burning. Animals have been killed. It's unbelievable. Nearly a third of their habitat has been destroyed. We're setting up a GoFundMe page to help the firefighters, the people, the animals of Australia.
There are people out there who've lost their lives trying to save homes. The people who've lost their lives and their homes. And last year's the plight of the animals and loss of their habitat that frankly is on a biblical scale and heartbreaking. Therefore tonight, I will be pledging $1 million.
WISE received a huge number of donations, both nationally and internationally.
I mean, I did untold number of international media interviews, and donations to WISE in this last few months have been phenomenal. In many ways, the international community values our wildlife more than we do. But these bushfires have made us realise that these species may not always be there.
And people who couldn't donate money donated their time or their sewing skills.
We've seen a huge turnaround in the amount of people that have volunteered for organisations. People sewing pouches, people making koala mittens, people donating animal food. People care for wildlife because they care.
It's an honour to be in a position where I can help these animals. I just wish that I'd started a long time ago. I could have helped save a lot more than what I have. I even do snakes now. I never, ever, ever thought that I would handle a snake, but I do it because it's another animal that needs... They don't need rescuing so much as relocations. I'm not so keen on doing it, but I will do it.
Wildlife has always been one of Andrew White's main concerns. He's a project manager at Batemans Bay Aboriginal Land Council. But when the fires hit down here...
I was up with my partner on her country, Gerringer country, so that's just east of Nowra. And there was fires there as well, so we were caught in that up there and we could not do nothing, you know. It was heartbreaking. The day I came back down, it sort of brings tears to me now. It's just... It's really hard. The pain that all the animals went through, our land went through, was it really killed me. I couldn't do nothing, you know, and all that hard work we put into trying to save these species and look after our country, it's sort of like, well... Where do we go now? What do we do? Have we got anything left to look forward to try and save? And not just the fauna, but the flora as well. We're the custodians. We should be looking after the land properly and correctly. And we're that crucial link as custodians. And that link has been broken from us. And that was the most heartbreaking thing, is that spiritual connection is really strong. I go out in the bush and I see our big trees as my family and all the animals as my family. And to see them go through that, it's just heartbreaking.
Andrew's been looking after endangered wildlife for a long time. He draws on tens of thousands of years of knowledge in his work on far south coast Yuin country.
Well, the first day I got back, actually, I went out back out on country straight away and tried to assess the devastation. And instead of feeding and looking after certain animals, we were looking after what we thought was important, like ants and our pollinators, our native bees and our frogs and our insects. To me, a kangaroo, he can hop 2 kilometres to get a feed, but a small little frog or an ant or a native bee, they can't get help from anywhere else. So we look after them because they look after us. When we first started and put out water stations and things like molasses and stuff to draw in insects, you know, that's the spark of life there. So our little pollinators and our ants, and to see them there, it was really heartwarming. All of us had a smile on our face. Well, that stoked. In turn from that, every time we came out there, that cycle was building, so we'd find different things, bigger things coming in from what we've started from something small. We just went to our ground roots on how to look after country. Everyone feels a part of this now because of the bushfires. Find something special and look after that. And then that'll open your eyes to that broader picture of what it all means to be connected to country, you know. And that's only a small part of it, but that's really a crucial part. Finding that something small, relate yourself to that, let it grow.
The animals that we live in amongst don't pose any of those existential threats to us. They just coexist, and I know that because here I coexist with wallabies, kangaroos, untold birds and possums. So they raid my veggie garden occasionally. Well, I put a net over it and it's sorted. I don't have cats, I don't have dogs, and I really try not to drive ever at dusk or dawn. But I've realised that I'm quite different to a lot of people, and maybe it's that which we take for granted. It's always there, we always assume it's going to be there.
After the fire, there was such a silence and a deficit of bird life. It was eerie. And one time I was up here and all of a sudden some kookaburras started laughing, and that was such a great sound to hear finally, that some birds had decided that they could come back. And we've seen some black cockatoos, we've seen an echidna wandering through, which was quite a thrill.
I've been telling people this a lot, go out in the bush or go out in a paddock, be it daytime or nighttime, listen to the country, listen to the bush, and something will catch your ear or catch your eye. It's about finding that or capturing what's there that's really, you know, it's got that connection with you in a way that you feel like you need to do something about it or need to be a part of.
First, I heard the insects come back. And then, in the ferns by my front door, I think they're leaf green tree frogs. I'm trying to change my language. Rather than possums live on my property, I now say I share this home with frogs, with wallabies, with roos, and with possums. Because unless I actually have a relationship with these animals, I won't care enough to protect them and their home.
You've been listening to From the Embers. This series has been brought to you by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia and is supported by the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas and the Paul Ramsey Foundation. Our guests were Nick Hopkins, Julie Taylor-Mills, Rachel McInnes, Francis Carlton, and Andrew White. Thank you to the WISE volunteers and all the wildlife rescuers across Australia. Special thanks to Anna Grakanen and Monica Nippler, PhD candidates in spotted tail quolls, and to the Eurobadella community. The producer was Alison Sara.
That's the beauty about Joey's, much easier than little children.
Yeah, absolutely. I had little children and it was very stressful in those fires.
Engineering by Tegan Nichols. Script consultation from Zoe Ferguson. And the theme composer was Oliver Beard.
And the executive producer was Sarah Mashman.
This podcast was made on the land of the Wobunja people of the Yuin Nation and the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. These lands were never ceded.